I first wanted to just thank Torah in Motion, particularly Rabbi Kelman, and a fellow named Menachem Butler, who I know was involved in putting this series together. This is my first virtual teaching. I'm very excited. And I hear a terrible echo. If the tech could take care of that. I think because Stanley Emerson has his mic on, not to call any names. But if Stanley could turn off his mic, that would be very helpful. In any case, I also wanted to thank all of you for giving me the opportunity to experience Sunday again. In Israel, Sunday is a regular work day, but I feel that through teaching you, 10 o'clock, at least on Eastern Standard Time, in North America, that I too get to feel that beautiful feeling that we call Sunday morning. In any case, we don't have a lot of time, and I really wanted to get going. This class is going to be atypical in the series. Generally, we're going to have a lot of sources that we're going to be looking at. Those sources will appear on the screen, and you'll all be able to look at them. This is truly an introduction to the topic, to the Talmud and to its world, but to the series in general, and because of that, we're really going to sort of speak without too many references to sources. So let's get going. First, I wanted to introduce the inquiry itself. Some of the questions that I'm going to ask here might seem almost foolishly simple, and I assume many of you have basic background in what the Talmud is. But nevertheless, we're going to go down that well-traveled ground in order to point out some things that we may have thought we knew, or we may have thought we knew in a certain way, and indeed there's another way of looking at it. So the inquiry is, what and what was its world? The name of the course is the Talmud in its world. And I want to ask four basic questions now, and I want these four questions, fear cautious, to somehow stay with us throughout the course. The first question is, what is the Talmud? Right? And more specifically, what is the Babylonian Talmud? Again, this is a question that most of us know what the Talmud is. We can point to that heavy place in our shelves and say, that is the Talmud, that is the Babylonian Talmud. But as we'll see, it's actually a bit more of a complicated question. So that's question number one. Question number two, again implied by the title, is what was its world? In other words, what was the geographical place in which the Babylonian Talmud took shape? What were the political issues involved? Right? Who was in charge of the government? Who was in charge of the Jewish institutions? What were the different religious factors there? Obviously, the Babylonia wasn't just rabbinic Jews. There were all ethnic and religious communities. Who were they? How did they interact, if they did at all, with the Jews in Babylonia and Babel? And finally, in more of a broader sense, what was the cultural context of Babylonia? What did it mean to be a Jew living in Babylonia between, let's say, the years 200 and 500 of the Common Era? That's our second question. So first, what is the Talmud, and what is the world in its many senses in which the Talmud took shape? The third question, which I've already hinted at in the second one, is what exactly is the relationship, or was the relationship, between the Talmud and its world? The Talmud is a text. It was an oral text. It's now a written text. And as a text, how did it interact with all of these different factors, the geographical, the political, the religious, the cultural? How did that relationship work between a text, whether oral or written, and its world? And finally, the goal of really the series, what we're trying to do, is by answering these first three questions, or really the second and third questions, what was the world of the Talmud, what was the relationship of the world of that world to the Talmud, I want to get a better sense of the first question. In other words, can we, by looking at the world of the Talmud, actually come to a great understanding not just of the world, but also of the Talmud itself? Those are the fear kashas. Those are the four questions that I want all of you, myself included, to keep in mind as we work through all of this exciting material. Now, in this opening lecture, I wanted to really do two things, and that relates to our questions. First, I want to explain what the Talmud is, and then, towards the end of the lecture, I want to give a sense of where we're going to be going. What's the direction of the lecture? How are we going to study the Talmud and its world? But before we even do that, I think I do have to give a little bit of a different kind of contextual talk to sort of explain where I'm coming from, where this series was generated, not just geographically. And only after we do that do I think that we can really get into the introduction. So we can call this an introduction to an introduction. And in a way, it's an introduction to a field that might be called academic Talmud, is probably the most common way to describe it. Now, academic Talmud, in a certain sense, is another derech halimud, is another approach to learning. Those of you familiar with Jewish history and Jewish intellectual history know that the Gemara wasn't just studied in one particular way from the time it was compiled and written down until November 15, 2009, but there were different approaches that different communities of learners applied to the text of the Talmud. So, for example, the beginning right after the time when the Talmud was compiled, we have a period known as the time of the Gaonim. The Gaonim approached the Talmud in various ways. Many of them were interested in Pesach and trying to understand how to extrapolate laws from the Yam HaTalmud, the Sea of the Talmud, but also in the ways in which they interpreted the Talmud itself, they had a few distinct approaches. One of the most well known was, I guess we could call it a lexical approach. In other words, they were interested in explaining a Talmudic passage via having very precise understanding of what the words meant. So we have another places in Gaonic literature, in the Svarim that were written by the Gaonim, in which they really list different words, different difficult words, explain their meaning, sometimes even say where they come from. Like if this is a foreign word, they'll say that the word comes from Arabic or from Persian. And through that explanation of that difficult word, come to give greater understanding of the passage in question. So that was one derech halimud, one of the most earliest derech halimud that Talmudic learning saw. And that derech actually lasted for some time. Its climax was a bit after the time of the Gaonim. The Sefer HaAruch by Rav Natan HaBavli was the first dictionary of the Talmud, really, that took all of those words, not all of the words in the Talmud, but nearly, especially the difficult words, and explain them. And it was very much informed by that first project of learning that the Gaonim began. You even have a bit of this, Derech, in another well-known parish, Rabbeinu Hananel, one of the most important earlier Mefarshim of the Gemara. Some of what he does is take is informed from his predecessor, the Aruch, and in a sense, all the way back from the time of the Gaonim. So that's one derech halimud. Then, any of you who are familiar with Gemara know that Rashi reigned supreme. Rashi also brought a distinct approach that he had learned from his Rebbeim, his Rebbeim's Rebbeim, in which the goal was to explain in the most concise, pithy way what the local Gemara in question was trying to say. Rashi generally was not interested in saying how a Gemara in Masechta Brachos relates to a Gemara in Masechta Chulin. Rather, Rashi was interested, and again, in incredibly formulating in the fewest words possible what a particular passage meant. And he inherited this derech really from his predecessors, most famously from Rabbeinu Gershom or HaGola, who really began this process, and even a bit before. So you have the Gaonim's approach, their focus on words by which they might build understanding of the Gemara. There's Rashi's local approach to a particular sugya. We have, for example, the Baalei Tosafot. They were actually very interested in relating one Gemara to another Gemara. to say and try to explain how this Gemara in the Sefer Brachot, which seems to contradict this Bracha in the Sefer Tefillin, really might not be a contradiction at all, but rather could be somehow harmonized and the problems could be explained. We could continue with the Ramban and his Beit Midrash. We could go on in the way his approach was to really summarize the Sugya. That was his Derech HaLimud. We could travel even further onto Pilpul, which we'll get to in a second. A few more centuries later, onto a Derech, a well-known Derech known as the Brisker Derech, and on until today. In other words, not each generation, but every few generations, a new Derech HaLimud, a new approach to Talmudic learning was developed. Became its own world of learning and its own language, one could say, and that often led into the next stage of learning. So, in a sense, we might say that academic Talmud is another Derech HaLimud. It's another way of learning. In a sense, I'm gonna show you how that's not exactly true. That there is somewhat of a break between what academic Talmud does and what these previous Derech HaLimud do. But I do want to emphasize one thing before we do that, and that is to say that each Derech HaLimud often had a shared group of assumptions, not just a shared language, but a shared group of assumptions. And through those assumptions, it was possible to really have a conversation that together as a school interpret Shas. And let me give you one example, for example, taken from Pilpul. Pilpul was a movement, I guess you could say its ancestry was with the Balei Tosfot, but it was a certain hair-splitting dialectical movement that took off steam in the 15th and 16th centuries. And it had, because it was a formal Derech HaLimud, had its own set of assumptions, had its own list of things that would be considered convincing, its own types of questions that it considered to be worth asking, and its own acceptable answers. Now, one of the interesting things that Pilpul did, and one of the things that bothered the Pilpulist, the person involved in Pilpul, was that every word in the Gemara had to be explained and accounted for. Why is this Gemara here? Now that seems to be a careful learner, a careful reader could assume. If you really want to understand what's going on, you have to interpret every single word. You have to account for why it's here, why it's in this grammatical form, etc., etc. But the Pilpulist took it one step further. Those of you who've learned Gemara know that often a Gemara will quote a Braisa, we'll soon explain what a Braisa is in a minute, but we'll quote a source from the Tanayim to give an answer, to ask a question, and it will use that source to begin a new phase in its conversation. Now, often the way the Gemara does this is that it quotes the source in full. In other words, instead of just quoting those few words that give rise to the question, the Gemara will quote 5 lines, because the few words that give rise to the question are found in those 5 lines. Now, the Pilpulist decided that not only is there a need to interpret every word, but there's even a need to account for that extra material, that material that apparently just sort of came along for the ride, was brought in, was cited in the Gemara because the Gemara was looking at a particular line in the larger Braisa. And that led to some of the greatest heights of Pilpul. Some of the greatest kiddushin that Pilpul advanced and brought forward were based on this kind of question. Now, when you look at some of the polemics against Pilpul that start coming out in the subsequent centuries, many of them have a problem with just the notion of chiddush, the notion that this is something new, something that wasn't done before. But also, some of them take issue with this very question. What does it mean that you can base an entire 10 pages of a Sefer Pilpul on a question that in previously had not seemed to lead to any difficulties? Other generations simply said the Gemara quotes the Braisa in full. The Gemara doesn't just quote the few words that bother it or that give rise to a question. And that sort of conflict, that polemic, really emphasizes the way in which each Derech HaLimud brings to the table not only its own chidushim, its own novel way of looking at the Gemara, but also its own set of shared assumptions, of truth claims, of what is acceptable as an answer and what is problematic, what is acceptable as a question and what is less acceptable. And you could say the same things, even taken to an extreme, with certain Hasidic approaches to Gemara. For example, Rav Tzedek of Lublin, who reads the Gemara in almost a mystical way, looks at a completely different angle of the Gemara. Within his circle, that was one way of reading Gemara, and that circle shared the assumptions of reading Gemara that way. But other circles might not share those assumptions. So when we think about the vast variety of Darchei Limud that have risen in Klal Yisrael in approaching the Gemara, and I just gave you a very short and abridged list, we have to remember that each new Derech HaLimud is really a world in and of itself. And the questions that Derech HaLimud asks aren't necessarily the questions that another Derech HaLimud would ask or that another Derech HaLimud would answer. Now, I think we could say the same thing about what I'm going to describe as the academic approach to Talmud study. And the reason why I'm doing this here, this isn't a series about academic Talmud, is that I feel the only way to, or the best way, I should say, to begin an inquiry like this, where we want to understand the way the Gemara relates to the real world around it, the historical world in which it arose, is only through an approach that is informed by academic questions, by historical inquiry. In other words, if our interest is not going to be in why Gemara, let's say, quotes a brice in full, like those interested in Philpol would want to hear, we need to really talk in the medium of the question that we're asking. If we have a historical question, then I think we should apply a historical method, a more critical, so to speak, not in the negative sense, method to trying to understand what the Gemara is, historically what it was, and what the world in which it arose. So as I said, in a certain way, you could look at academic Talmud as another Derech HaLimud. But at the same time, it has to be admitted that the whole notion of academic Talmud in the firm world, for good reason, leads to certain problems. Certain really uncomfortabilities that many of us, myself included, feel when we engage in this kind of learning. Now, I think part of that has to do with the history of academic Talmud, right? So we could trace the history of many of these Darchei Limud. We could talk about the lexical approach of the Gaonim and the dialectical approach of the Baalei Tosfot. To be honest, the academic approach really began in a movement called by some Chachmat Yisrael, the wisdom of Israel, but an approach that was really advanced by many Maskilim. Some Maskilim consider themselves almost paradoxically to still be traditionalist. Others were more radical. But within this group of people who were engaged in, we could say, a new Derech HaLimud, they started the history of this method of learning. And that, I think, is one reason why academic Talmud creates certain problems in the firm world, just by virtue of its history. The fact that it began in a movement that in some senses was antithetical to everything the firm world stands for tradition, for conservatism with a small c, that history can be problematic. But I think there's something much deeper. In a way, academic Talmud isn't just another Derech HaLimud. It's really a completely new and different, non-traditional approach to learning. And I think that has to be admitted even by those of us who think that there is spiritual value in pursuing a more academic, scholarly approach to Gemara learning. Let me just sort of share with you some of the assumptions of academic learning that that might be problematic. I see that Bill is typing something. I don't know if there's a question. I would want to wait a few minutes, a few more minutes for questions, but if it's a problem with the technicalities of the Shear, then that's okay as well. Let me give you an example, a few basic tenets of academic learning. One is that the text that appears in front of those who learn Gemara, is not necessarily the best text, is not necessarily the most accurate text. This is something that's known as textual criticism. In other words, if you're a firm person and you go to your shop and you want to pull off, again, a Gemara Bracha, and you open it up, you're looking at a certain edition of that text. The Vilna edition is the classic edition of Shah. And nevertheless, one of the most basic things that academic Talmudists do is to try to get at what they believe the most accurate text is. Very often, the most accurate text, almost always, if there's a problem with the text, if there are issues that arose in the transmission of the text of the Gemara, then that is often the Vilna Shah is not accurate, doesn't have the most accurate reading. And just by virtue of being engaged in that process, that can create certain problems for firm people, because it's basically, it could be seen as an attack on tradition. We learned from the Vilna Shah, and now the claim is that the Vilna Shah doesn't necessarily represent the best tradition of what the Gemara is trying to say. Now, even beyond that, even beyond questioning the very text of the Gemara, another thing that happens while working on the text, which is the base level of academic Talmud, is that the way the solutions are found is non-traditional. So, for example, when the Gemara discusses different scribal corrections that Ezra engaged in, or others engaged in, if there's a problem in a text, so there are different halakhic ways of dealing with that, not that this is applicable today, but, for example, if you have two manuscripts that read the word Vayomer, and one that has the word Va'amar, so because of the halachic principle of Rov, the two manuscripts that have Vayomer are going to be seen as referable, and that is how a halachically, in a very simplistic sense, a better text would be established. Yet the way academics fix a text, which to begin with, the fixing of the text is problematic, is that they try to bring all kinds of principles into how one fixes a text. That instead of the most obvious, for example, reading, an academic Talmudist would say, no, really it's exactly what's more difficult, what seems more problematic, that's the accurate text. In other words, all of the different assumptions that academics might bring to fixing a text are often non-traditional and certainly non-halakhic. So that's one area of academic Talmud, and that's obviously one area of academic Talmud that could be seen as problematic in a firm world. Moving on a bit from the base level of the text to thinking about how the text was put together gives rise to another area of academic scholarship and another area of questions. And that is, academic Talmud often sees the Talmud as in motion, right? So this is, the venue here is Torah in motion. And from an academic approach, the Torah is in motion. The Talmud is in motion. What do I mean by that? In other words, we'll get to this a bit more in a few minutes, but the Talmud, if you open it up, isn't just words that were written, let's say, according to traditionalists by Ravina and Ravashi to explain the Mishnah. Rather, the Gemara includes all sorts of sources. So it might include a Braisa from the time of the Mishnah. It might include a Tosefta. It might include an early Amora's opinion on something. And all of these texts from a Talmudist, academic Talmudist approach grew in different times and sometimes in different environments. So in a way, instead of thinking of the Talmud as really engaged in one conversation, the Talmudist might think that there is a progression, that there's sort of, again, a Talmud in motion that's occurring here, and that the goal of academic learning would be sort of to discern how things are developing, perhaps, and this is something that maybe an academic might say, the Mishnah originally meant one thing, and later generations understood it in a different way, and then maybe a further generation understood what that earlier interpretation was differently than it actually was, etc., etc. In other words, things build on each other and they develop, not necessarily in a linear fashion. That, too, is a major tenet, a major part of this academic development. And that, understandably, is also another problematic aspect of academic Talmud. And finally, and this actually is going to relate directly about to what we're going to try to do here, is the fact that an academic will assume that the Gemara, and not just assume, but will bear in mind constantly, that the Gemara was actually and truly compiled in a real historical place, by real historical people, by human beings, with real historical factors that existed in the surrounding environment. Now, of course, many traditionalists know this as well. They know that Ravina and Ravashi were not Malachim, but they were real people. They know that Bavel is a real place, was a real place. The Gemara didn't come down from space. It didn't come down from Shemayim either, but rather was something that was produced through human learning. But the academic might emphasize this aspect, all kinds of things in the text, concepts, developments, which we refer to. Now, this isn't a series about the theology of academic learning. And I don't want to take that much time for this. If we do have a little time at the end, maybe we can have some questions here. But I just want to say sort of what my approach is to dealing with some of these issues. I can't really get into details now. Maybe we'll have another occasion to do this. But I think that the best way to really understand this and perhaps come to terms with this, if you want to come to terms with it, is by understanding that even within Torah Shebaal Peh itself, whether it's Gemara, whether it's Medrash, often when just trying to describe what Torah Shebaal Peh is and how it works, phrases like, or psukim really from Devarim, Parak Lamed, will be used like Lo Bashamayim. Right? Lo Bashamayim is a principle that is supposed to, in a sense, describe the basic accessibility of Torah. That Torah is something that all of us can accomplish, all of us can do. We have it within us to do this, so. But it is applied in certain contexts also to the process of learning Torah. In other words, Torah learning is something, and Torah deciding, stock, is something that's within the capability of human beings. You have to go through lots of training. You have to learn for many years to be able to truly get to the level where one can work with Torah in that way. But the assumption seems to be of a number of Makoros that Torah Shebaal Peh is very much a human process with divine sanction, of course, but a process in which it's all about human activity and human creativity. Now, if that's the case, then, in a sense, studying these various human phenomena, the fact that the Gemara existed in a real place and might have been affected by certain realities, whether they're economic, geographical, etc. The fact that the text developed in stages, as humans in each generation would add things to the previous generation, that in a sense is a celebration of this principle of Lo Bashamayim, of the sense that it's us humans who are able to contribute to this. It's a human enterprise, and in a sense, if we do focus on those human aspects, I think that we actually can hear echoes of the divine, because ultimately, it's the divine sanction, it's the fact that HaKadosh Baruch Hu told us Lo Bashamayim Hi, and gave us sort of permission to engage in the creation of Torah Shebaal Peh, that's what makes Torah Shebaal Peh what it is, not simply a human process, but a human process that's powered by a divine mode. Maybe we'll take a few questions now. We can try it through your microphones if you have any, or chatting, and if there aren't any questions, we'll continue. I'll just look at my screen and see if anyone asks anything. Okay. I guess we can continue. Oh, no, we have a question. Okay, Yisrael Kashkin, will you give some concrete examples of the time and place relevance of the creation of the Talmud. Well, we're going to be doing some of that in this course. So this is really just an introductory class, so I won't do that right now. We will get to those sorts of questions. Here, I just want to give a framework to sort of the approach, what I want to call a Derech HaLimud, and sort of explain its context. But now I want to get on, if it's okay with all of you, to the first question that I want to ask today. For those of you who are in learning, it's almost a comical question. You know the answer. And that question is, what is the Talmud? Right? What is the Gemara? So, first of all, I think most of us know that the Talmud is and has been the kind of nerve center in the greatest sense of the Jewish people for well over a thousand years. As many of you know, we were referred to as people of the book. And many non-Jews thought that that meant that we were people of the Bible, people that, you know, were immersed constantly in the study of Tanakh, in the study of Torah, Shabbat. And in fact, sort of the joke was on them. Not that we also didn't learn Torah Shabbat, and Torah Shabbat is the anchor of everything that then comes in Torah Shabbat Keh. But in actuality, historically, the greatest time that was spent by most Jewish communities and the greatest intellectual energy that was placed into any kind of Jewish learning was placed into Limud HaGemara. And into the learning of specifically the Bavli, right? Talmud is sort of a catchphrase. It could refer to Yishalmi, but this is clearly, it was about, for most communities throughout the ages, that energy, that intellectual energy, that spiritual learning energy was put into Gemara. To the point that when some non-Jews realized that the Jews really weren't people of what they called the Old Testament, but were rabbinic Jews, it was all about this other tradition that they had, right? Torah Shabbat Keh. They ended up burning our Talmud by the cartloads because they realized that we didn't really embody just Torah Shabbat Keh, but all of our energies, all of our practices, everything that we do comes through Torah Shabbat Keh. And this, in a sense, could even be said about denominations other than Orthodoxy. Even those denominations who have in many ways broken with that straight tradition of Torah Shabbat Keh are still very much rabbinic Jews. All of the practices, many of the practices that they continue to do are based on rabbinic Judaism, even if that's not always acknowledged. So most of us know that this thing called Talmud, this thing called Gemara, is really the nerve center, the absolute center of Jewish learning, has been and continues to be occupied that. But what is it? Right? What is that nerve center? Now, writ large, we know what it is. Right? The Bavli is, we might say, a Peirush on the Mishnah. Right? It's there to explain what the Mishnah is trying to do. And it follows the order of the Mishnah. It follows the Masechta. In other words, we begin with Brachos, and then we skip because there aren't any Masechtas in the Bavli on the rest of the Mizraim, etc., etc. In other words, it continues the order of the Masechta, the Mishnah, and it also continues the order within the Masechta itself. This is all very simple. But it's so simple that we sometimes don't realize how remarkable it is. If you look at other kinds of Jewish Svarim from a long time ago, let's say we look right after the time of the Gemara. So we have books like Halachot Gedolot, Halachot Pesukot. These are works that are from the Gaonim that follow a different order. They don't necessarily follow the order that was set by the Mishnah, but they have their own principles of organization. You could definitely say the same thing for the Shiltos. The Shiltos was an important Gaonic work that follows the Parshios of the Torah and uses that order to then then raise discussions and raise issues and questions that it wants to raise. You could even continue well into the time of the Rishonim, beginning with the Rambam. The Rambam completely reordered the system. He didn't work according to the order of Mishnah. But the Gemara, the Bavli, just like the Yerushalmi, works according to the order of the Mishnah, and in that sense could really be seen as a commentary, again in a very broad sense, as a commentary on the Mishnah. Now, if that's the case, let's just back up for 1 minute and talk about what the Mishnah is, because if we're going to try to understand in this year what the Talmud is, then we have to know what the Mishnah is. Just taking a few minutes, we could say as follows. The Mishnah was the first rabbinic legal document. It was put together, it was compiled by Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi, Rabbein or Kadosh, sometime at the beginning of around 200 of the Common Era. And it, even though he was the compiler, and it was compiled around that time, nevertheless, it contains opinions that stretch back in history. So even by looking at the names and figuring out how the generations work, which is a topic of study that the Gaonim were already involved in, including especially Rav Saadia Gaon, we know that the Mishnah isn't just sort of the statement of Rabbi Yehuda Nasi and his generation, but it includes all of these earlier generations. And even more than that, even though most of these earlier generations, most of the opinions quoted in the Mishnah, begin in the first century of the second year of the Common Era, even though we have earlier opinions as well, nevertheless, we know that the halacha that's represented in the Mishnah is an ancient, ancient halacha. But even if you wanted to take a strict historical perspective and say, regardless of Masorah, are there any historical proofs for the antiquity of the halacha contained in the Mishnah? The answer is yes. We have all kinds of historical proofs that show that this is very much reflects the halachic environment well before the beginning of the first millennium of the Common Era. So, for example, if you look at things that were written in Bayit Sheni, like Sefer HaYovelim, the Book of Jubilees, even though in many ways, from a rabbinic perspective, it's a sectarian work, it has a different calendar, it has very different approaches to very many different halachot, nevertheless, one can still tell that it's in the same halachic orbit, in the same halachic universe as this thing that we call the Mishnah hundreds of years later. You could definitely see this with the Dead Sea Scrolls as well, whether it's Sarach HaYachad, which is a well-known work from the Dead Sea Scrolls, the manual of really the rule of the community, or Miktat Matzeh Torah. These are works that even if they're sectarian, even if they contain opinions that are specifically argued with in the Mishnah as being Sadducean, it still shows that there's this broader world of halacha, even if it's from the rabbinic perspective, the wrong halacha, that already exists well before the earliest named opinions that are often cited in the Mishnah. So we have this thing called the Mishnah, which is interested in halacha. It doesn't really quote sukkim. Sometimes there's a shene'emar where it bases itself on sukkim, but that is really the realm of medrash halacha. The Mishnah states its law. It is based on much, much older material. And it's on this Mishnah that the Bavli comments. Now, how does this work? What do I mean that the Bavli then comments the Mishnah? It's actually not so simple. So, fairly soon after the Mishnah is compiled, we have almost an immediate acceptance of the Mishnah. When I say acceptance, that doesn't mean, okay, I'm sorry, there's a question. Steve Friedman is asking, any clue what happened historically, if at all, that it occurred to Yehuda Nasi to compile the Mishnah? I'm not going to take the time here right now to really get into this question. That's a question that looms very large in the world of Rishonim. One approach has to do with the fact that people were forgetting things, or another approach is that there were more machlokesim that were arising in Klal Yisrael. The Rambam has a famous passage that tries to deal with this question. From an academic perspective, and we're going to get to this in 1 minute, the Mishnah was not really written down in Rebbe's time. It's actually a remarkable thing. Yes, there might have been a few notes here and there, and this relates to something that the Rambam talks about, but the Mishnah remains an oral document. So if that's the case, what does it mean that Rebbe Yehuda Nasi put together the Mishnah? It means that he published it orally. What does it mean that he published it orally? That's almost an oxymoron from our perspective. What it means is that he set a certain formula and certain words that had to be memorized in a very precise way. And he actually, in time, there were a whole group of people, professional memorizers, whose task was to commit this Mishnah to memory. Now, Sri Friedman, I'm moving a little away from your question now, and hopefully we'll be able to get back to it, but I just want to continue this train of thought. This group of people, interestingly enough, were called Tanayim. Now, not the Tanayim such as Rabbi Akiva, Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah. These were a professional group of Tana, people who would Tana, would recite the verb, would recite the traditions of Rabbi Yehuda Nasi, and apparently also other traditions that didn't make it into the Mishnah. And that was their job, right? Often the Gemara has not such nice things to say about them because they were just walking books. They were great in their capacity to memorize, but they didn't understand what they were saying. They didn't understand really what the content was. Their job was really to be this walking book. So it seems that Rabbi Yehuda Nasi publishes this Mishnah orally. There are people who memorized it and are constantly restating it. And then, based on that, the next generation comes and accepts this. Sometimes they argue with it. Certain Amoraim, like Rav, really just Rav for the most part, are able to argue with the Mishnah. But there's an acceptance that this is something to reckon with, beyond to reckon with. This is the primary document with which all conversations, all Talmudic conversations are going to take place. And with that begins the first few generations of dealing with the Mishnah. We're not up to what Gemara is yet. We have Amoraim who are dealing with this corpus called the Mishnah. Now at the same time, they're also dealing with something else. They're dealing with other traditions from the times of the Tanaim, and again beyond, as we described, that come from other things that we call brisos, certain collections of brisos. A famous collection that we have in more or less a similar form to the one in the Gemara is called the Tosefta. It's a collection of brisos that in some ways relate to and maybe even comment upon Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi's Mishnah, and in other ways are at variance, sometimes argue with Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi's Mishnah. And the task of these early Amoraim, and continuing later Amoraim as well, is to comment on these brisos, to maybe account for what the relationship is between these brisos and Mishnah, etc., etc. So that is sort of the earlier work of the Amoraim in learning what they were trying to do. But there was much more going on than that as well. If you really learn through Shas, so you don't just look at certain particular sugyos. If you're doing Daf Yomi, for example, it's a good way to do it. Then you'll know that there are all kinds of things that make their way into the Gemara. Things that apparently have nothing to do with the Mishnah, or are only barely tangentially connected to what's going on in the Mishnah. And all kinds of things that we might even initially say, how is this part of sort of a holy Masorah? How is this part of our tradition? You know, recipes for different drinks, different pharmacological things. What works in healing? What doesn't work in healing? Etc., etc. All kinds of things that amass in the Gemara as time goes on, sometimes often quoted directly by some of the Amoraim, but at other times just placed there by the Stemayim, which is a group of people I'm going to get to in a second. I see Ethan has a one-word question, and that's Sabarayim. I don't know if we're going to get to that today. But in any case, this is what's happening as the Gemara begins to grow, so to speak. Begins to grow not just from the comments of the Amoraim, who are dealing with the Mishnah and the relationship between the Mishnah and Tanakh, or the relationship between the Mishnah and these other Brisos, who are dealing with the relationship or simply explaining Sukkim and Tanakh and have all kinds of drashos. Not only all of the extraneous material that doesn't seem to be related directly to the Mishnah, but really deals with everything under the sun that was of importance to the Amoraim. But we also have, and this is finally getting to a beginning to answer what the Gemara is, we have all of the comments that aren't attributed to anybody. They're anonymous comments that try to explain what's going on in some of these discussions. So Rav will say a comment on the Mishnah, and he seems to say something that's at variance with it. So this anonymous layer, you might call it, this anonymous material, will try to deal with all of this material and try to put a framework on it, try to make it move in a certain direction, try to edit it, so to speak, until it actually looks like the Gemara, more or less, that we pull down from our bookshelf and open up. In other words, if we want to begin to answer the question of what is the Talmud, we have to first atomize it. We have to think of all the different parts that make up the Gemara, and then think about how all those parts were put together and became and turned into something that that is now its own world, its own existence, which we call the Talmud. Now, time is really moving quickly, and we have to end on time because my wife is actually giving a shiur on this computer in another 12 minutes. But let's continue a bit more and talk about what this Talmud is. Now, there's a well-known phrase that doesn't pick up steam until the time of the Rishonim and beyond, called Yam HaTalmud, the Sea of Talmud. Now, what that phrase is getting at is, I think, that not just the vastness of what the Gemara is, but also that the Gemara is a world unto itself. It contains its own ecosystem, we might say, right? Just like a yam, just like a sea. It contains maybe even its own weather. It produces its own weather systems, and all kinds of things happen because of the sea and because of the Talmud. In other words, it's not just this very, very, very vast Mesorah, but it's also its own special world. That being the case, if we kind of think more about what it means to be a sea, the sea isn't just a commentary on the shore, right? The sea has a relationship with the shore. The sea, so to speak, takes off from the shore. But the sea isn't just a commentary on the shore. And pardon the parable here, or the metaphor, but the Gemara isn't just, and I hope I've given a little sense of how this is the case, isn't just a commentary on the Mishnah. It takes a point of departure, like the sea is from the shore, but it turns into its own world, and its own, I think it's part of how we have to think about the Gemara. But beyond that, okay, I see a question. Oh, I'm sorry, I don't know how to see hands raised. So I'm going to stop for a few questions. If we have to pick up from this point or close to this point next time, then we'll have to do that. But let's see. Helen has a question. Hina Ryder has a question. What is her question? Do you want to ask the question? Okay. It was a comment. Yeah, sure. Would you like to make a comment or save it for later? Oh, okay. You're welcome. My pleasure. We'll get to that in 1 minute. I'll tell you where I'm teaching from. I'm teaching from Modi'in, which is a town in between Yerushalayim and Tel Aviv in Israel. Let me just try to finish this train of thought. The big question that we're going to... I'm sorry. I meant your perspective. So where am I teaching from? Existentially, I currently am employed in a university, if that's what you mean. But I've taught, yes, Alan, from this class and on, we're going to be all source sheets, and we're going to be learning text together. This is just because I wanted to talk for a long time and bore you. No, not to bore you, but I wanted to really just have the chance to give a long lecture and give a little context. But we're really only going to be working off of source sheets from here on in. Let me just try to wrap up here for what we're doing, and we'll pick up from this point later. But now that we sort of just have a basic sense of the nuts and bolts of what Talmud is, that really only raises the question, how did this vast sea come to be? And what is the meaning of all these different things inside the sea? further, what's the relationship between the Talmud, this vast, amorphous, incredible thing, much more than a commentary, and the community that produces it? So it's how do we get inside that world? How do we ask the questions that give us the answers to try to figure out what was going on then and how this world functioned, this world of the Talmud, the city of the Talmud, and how it came to be? Now again, taking sort of historical perspective for a second, we have a problem. In history generally, there's a, right, in firm history, or the way it's articulated by firm people, there's a problem. We have a principle in Tanakh, in Torah, called Al-Pi Shnayim Edim Yakum Davar, that you can only establish something historically, or in the Torah, in terms of testimony, if you have two witnesses. When it comes to understanding what was going on in Jewish Babylonia, all we have is the Gemara. All we have, and I'm not complaining, even as a historian, but all we have is, yes, this vast thing called the Gemara, but nothing else really that seems to corroborate it. Not like it needs corroboration, but nothing else that really speaks of similar historical incidences from a different perspective. So, for example, we might have evidence in different things in Eretz Yisrael. Let's say the Mishnah will talk about a phenomenon, and we'll have an archaeological dig that will contain materials that relate to that phenomenon. That doesn't really exist when it comes to learning Gemara, and that's going to be something we're going to try to struggle with and deal with. Because it's going to be my assumption, and I'll end here for the time being, that if we actually look at the world in which the Gemara grows up and takes shape, and if we look at all of the different factors there, whether they're geographical, and next week we're going to look at the land of Babylonia. Where was the Jewish community? Hopefully I'll try to use some images from Google Maps, and we'll really get a good glimpse at what was going on there. We'll take a field trip. What was the geography? How did the geography relate to the Jewish experience and relate to the actual Gemara? What were the political factors? What were the different religions that surrounded the Jewish people? All of these questions, I hope, are going to allow us to approach in one way the bigger question. In other words, by looking at all of these aspects of what the world of the Talmud is, I hope that ultimately we can figure out or begin to figure out what really the Talmud is. And next we're going to try to explain this question a little more. So we have 5 minutes for quick questions. I see that Bert from West Hempstead wants to know my email address. I'll give it right now. I'll type it in. It's very simple. It's my name, shysecunda@gmail.com, and I'd love to hear from all of you. In just a few minutes, as Rabbi Kelvin said, Daphne Secunda is going to be giving a lecture on 8 great and evil Jewish philosophers. Are there any more questions that I could answer in the next couple of minutes, or are we really out of time?
Can you hear me? Yes. Classes are recorded. There is a nominal fee for the recording of the class. Just go to torahinmotion.org, click the MP3 library. You'll see all of last week's classes are up. We guarantee to have them up within 48 hours and hopefully sooner, but the guarantee is within 48 hours all classes are posted, audio and video. And if anybody would like to type in a question or speak by mic, you know, feel free to do so.
And we do have
we do have classes also later on today and this evening, but okay, that's on the website. Okay, I'm sorry.
Jay, is there a way to print the sources once they're posted?
Yes, I mean, in the future, and I think we have, and we'll send a note to all our speakers. They can send us the sources in advance. We can actually post it both on our website, and we can send it out to everybody, and plus, you know, you'll see it on the screen. Yes, so in the future, I know next week he's going to have a lot of sources. This was the non-source introductory week.
And I'll send
out. Thanks, Jay. Thanks, Shai.
Any further questions that I'll try to address really next? When was the end of the Amoraic period? It seems to be around 500 CE. That's the working date. Maybe we'll try to get into that a little more, but I think we're going to have to close it. Maybe type in a few more questions, and I'll try to address them at the beginning of next year.